Welcome to the Building Stories podcast series. My name is Amy Barnes, and I'll be your host as we explore some of Ontario's built heritage. This series will include 15 podcasts in total, so if you enjoy today's show, be sure to check out some of the others. Each podcast is going to explore a different topic related to heritage conservation in different regions of Ontario. The podcast will include a brief history of the building, interviews with people who have some connection to this space, but the ultimate goal is to try and tell stories about the buildings, stories about the space that most people don't know. Each one is going to be different, because the truth is, each building has a different past, and each building has a different story to tell us. So without further ado, let's get started on today's topic. Today we head to South Bruce Gray County and into the town of Walkerton, Ontario. Now, Walkerton was named after the first settler, Joseph Walker, who in order to satisfy the conditions of the settlement, had to clear a 12-acre land parcel. Not a simple feat. With nothing more than a collection of log huts in a forest, Walker established a mill, which laid the foundation for a community to spring up around it. And so it did. Now, for many listeners, the only thing they know about Walkerton is that they suffered from a devastating E. coli outbreak in 2000. And so I want to change that. Today, I'm going to tell you the story of a magnificent building in the town, so that when you think of Walkerton, you might think of this podcast and how you learned all about Victoria Jubilee Hall. The hall you see today was built to replace Walkerton's original wooden town hall. The cornerstone was laid on August 15, 1897, commemorating Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, and it's for this reason that the hall was called Victoria Jubilee Hall. It has always been the focal point of the downtown architecturally, as one can't miss it when you enter the town from East Hill. But it is also a focal point on a community level, bringing together members of the town in a variety of capacities. We're going to talk about what the hall has to offer in a while, but for now, let's talk about the design of the hall. The building was designed by Toronto architect A.R. Dennison and was constructed by Henry Clark. Clark used local fieldstone and marl brick. Now, it's a multi-purpose space that has an impressive 8 different levels inside it. It is of solid construction, and in some places, the walls are 5 bricks thick. Now, there's a building that was built to last. I learned this fact when I had the pleasure of speaking with Mary Robinson Ramsey, who has been involved with Victoria Jubilee Hall from day one. In fact, she is still very active in the community. She has been the chairperson for the South Bruce Gray branch of the ACO, was the chair for the Victoria Jubilee Hall Committee, as well as she's been very active with the Jubilee Arts and Music Committee, which does all the programming for the hall. Mary initially got involved in 1995 because local council, who owned the building since 1897, wanted a group of citizens to work with them as they said they were looking to do upgrades or doing renovations on the space. The group would become the Friends of Jubilee Hall. So Mary diligently sat at council meetings for over 2 years waiting for things to get off the ground. She said that over time it became obvious that their desire to rejuvenate the space was the superficial agenda, and they didn't intend to follow through with it. When the issue would come up with council, they would provide some reason for why things couldn't work out, and the committee would take those numbers, work with them, and come back with an alternative solution for how it could indeed work. This seemed to fall on deaf ears, though, as at one point, the town tried to remove the heritage designation with no doubt the intention to demolish it. When this happened, so many people objected that they quickly backed down and eventually offered to sell the hall to the ACO for $1. Before I get too ahead of the story, I want to let Mary explain how the local South Bruce Gray ACO branch came into existence because of this experience.
We realized we needed to create a nonprofit group, etc. And a cousin of mine was up visiting and she said, well, do you know about the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario? And I didn't. So she told me all about it and put me in touch with them. And they came to our rescue, helping us understand the steps we needed to take. And immediately we had, by becoming a branch, we had their nonprofit status and the charitable number. And they guided us through the various steps. And Victoria Jubilee Hall is actually one of the very few structures that the Architectural Conservancy owns. Their name is on the deed.
The committee meets about 4 times a year to ensure everything is operating smoothly. Since the success of this undertaking, the committee has also been asked to consult on numerous other local initiatives where buildings are at risk of being lost. Now, unlike some of these other buildings that really struggle to generate revenue and become self-sufficient, the Hall has office space by which the rent generated allows them to pay for electricity, water, and ongoing maintenance. The building also has a magnificent opera hall, which is one of only a handful left in Ontario from that era. I asked Mary if she could give me a little bit more background of the history of the space, and she told me that a caretaker lived in the hall from the beginning. One of the families who did this was the Ferguson family. So here's Mary to explain more about the Fergusons.
From early on, R.B. Ferguson and his wife lived in the hall with their 10 children. And I gather their kitchen living area was probably down closer to the ground level, because in those days, with wood fires, you had to be careful. But they all slept up in the very top floor, so they had to go 5 flights of stairs up to their sleeping accommodations. And Mr. Ferguson was there because they had to keep the furnaces stoked regularly, and he was the police chief and the caretaker of the hall. And later his son Jack lived there with his wife and 5 children doing the same duties. And a few years after Jack retired, his daughter Grace and her husband Wally Wood took over the caretaking duties at the hall. So they lived there until 1972. And the other reason the Fergusons were there, especially RB and Jack, was the Bell. Bell was purchased in Troy, New York, before Victoria Jubilee Hall was built. There was a wooden town hall, and the Bell was purchased looking forward to a more permanent town hall, and it sat in the adjacent market square until it was hoisted to its home in the tower of the new hall. So that would have been in 1897 or 1898. But it was purchased in 1870. So when the Fergusons were there, the bell was rung at every day on a regular basis. 7 a.m. signaled the beginning of the work in the factories. At 12 noon and 1 p.m. it marked the beginning and the end of the lunch hour. 6 p.m. it was rung to mark the end of the workday, and at 9 p.m. it signaled the curfew for anybody aged 16 or younger. And Sunday mornings it was rung at 10:30 to remind people to get to church. And it also had a clapper on the side, and when there was a fire or a drowning in our river, the clapper was rung incessantly to summon help, so all the volunteer firemen would rush to the fire or whatever. So the bell played a very, very important part in the town for many decades.
The bell Mary speaks of is the same one that is currently there. It was examined when they were doing renovations and found to be in excellent shape. It is not rung as much as it used to be, but you can still hear its chimes when there is a special performance being given. Speaking of performances, I asked Mary more about the opera hall. She said the acoustics are amazing because the space was designed at a time when there was no amplification systems. Because of this, they use contour and wood to give such a dynamic sound. She also said that right from the beginning, the hall has always been used by both local and out-of-town performers. That tradition continues today.
On the local level, we have a group called County Town Players, and it was interesting that in 2006, when we had a homecoming, they created from historical vignettes a 6-part play that went around town, and they ended up at Victoria Jubilee Hall with Queen Victoria on the stage. It was quite fun. Prior to that, when we took over the building, we had a celebration and a small parade. A lady at that time who played the role of Queen Victoria, her name was Irene Wesley, the lady's name. She had a dress owned by her aunt, who wore it when she was presented in the royal court in Germany. And at that time, the person she was presented to was Queen Victoria's own daughter. Those were a couple of fun local things. Now, we've had many, many really good professional performers. One of the more touching situations was Stan Rogers performed here just very shortly before he died. When we hear Stan Rogers, we tend to think of him very, very fondly, and we were lucky to hear him before he died. And one of the recent fun things, in the middle of the Quartetto Gelato performance, their accordionist, who was extremely skilled, really, really, really skilled, sat on the stage all by himself, and on his accordion played Bach, Toccata, and Fugue. And I didn't think I would ever see this, but when he finished, the whole audience stood and gave him an ovation, a standing ovation. And it just took my breath away. I didn't think I would ever see that here.
The Opera Hall can seat 300 people and has a wraparound balcony that ensures there's not a bad seat in the house and the intimate nature of the performance is not compromised. For those who might be interested in catching a performance, you can see the full list of offerings on their Victoria Jubilee Hall webpage. I then asked Mary if she had any unique stories about the hall that she could share, and she had many little tidbits which I will share with you now.
Well, we've come across pictures of people who were going off to both world wars and others who did return, and inevitably they seemed to gather and they'd have their photo taken in front of this, what was called the town hall, and then they'd be off to war, or they'd arrive home and have their photo taken and then go to their families. So that's quite moving. I don't know if you're aware that the fire engines were right in the hall, and the fire hoses in those days were canvas. And they used to, one of the reasons for the bell tower was to suspend the canvas fire hoses after the guys had come back from fighting the fire, because the hoses had to dry out. The tower was a very necessary part of that whole operation. There was also a police station in there, and there is still a police cell down in the basement that you can see. It doesn't have the door on it, but the cell is there.
Mary had one last story about the clock tower she wanted me to mention. Now, originally the building was built for $10,000, and at that time they had intended to put up 4 mechanical clocks on each side of the bell tower. The council of the day found that the clocks would cost $5,000 each, which would mean to do all 4 would cost twice as much as the entire building itself. When the committee was preparing for a homecoming celebration in 2006, a man named Mac Kirstein approached Mary with a donation and basically said, "I've just sold a piece of property. I've donated my body to medical research, so that will save on funeral costs." And he said, "Do you think we could get some clocks into that tower before homecoming?" Well, the team scrambled, but because of the digital nature of clocks, they were reasonably priced, and therefore they made it happen. So the clocks that are in the tower now work and chime on the half hour and hour. Needless to say, Mac was thrilled, and so too was the community. Well, that wraps up our podcast for today. I hope you enjoyed the story of Victoria Jubilee Hall, and I would like to thank Mary Robinson Ramsey for speaking with me not once, but twice. If you want to learn more about the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario and its involvement with the preservation and conservation of buildings all over Ontario, the ACO is celebrating its 80th anniversary by putting together a book. This book will feature 80 buildings the organization has had a hand in saving over the last 80 years. Now, the Building Stories episode you heard today is just one that will be included, but there are many more stories to discover. You can get the book starting in November 2013 by ordering it online at their website. The Building Stories podcast series could not have been made possible without our sponsors, so a big thank you to the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, the Heritage Resource Centre at the University of Waterloo, the Centre for Community Mapping, the Computer Systems Group at the University of Waterloo, and the Government of Ontario. If you have any comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email the Building Stories team at info@buildingstories.co or send them a tweet @buildingstories, which is BLDG_stories, and of course you can find them on Facebook under the Building Stories Facebook page. These podcasts have been written, produced, and hosted by myself, Amy Barnes, and I'd like to take this last moment to thank you all for listening.